Well, hello there, listeners. You already know what this means. That's right, we're taking a journey back into some of the stories we've already told. So enjoy this rewind.
Samantha.
I heard my 2-year-old daughter talking in her room in the middle of the night. I went in and asked her what she was doing. She said, talking to Samantha. She's on the ceiling. My wife had miscarried a few months prior. It was a girl. We were going to name her Samantha.
Clearly not human.
As a little kid, I was terrified of lots of things. I'd never seen anything close to a horror film, not even The Nightmare Before Christmas, because of how jumpy I was. So naturally, the dark freaked me out. I was really nightmare prone, which caused everyone to say what happened to me was a dream, but this was different. It was more vivid, too realistic to be a dream. I shared a room with my sister around the age of 7, but she was off at a sleepover party the night it happened. I was hiding under my sheets like the cowardly kid I was. I decided to poke my head out to get some cool air, and I saw something in my room, something clearly not human. I called it an alien at the time because that's the closest thing my horror ignorant mind could liken it to. Now I see it as more similar to the Rake or the Mothman. Its head was big and egg-shaped like those stereotypical gray aliens, far too big for its tiny slender body. It was totally naked. Pale gray or ashen white skin, the lack of light made it hard to tell. All the bones were visible. Its tiny shriveled genitals just hung there between its legs. Its hands were way too big for the toothpick-like arms. It was standing at a really unnatural angle. Its eyes were totally black and shiny. They seemed to be the only feature on its weird head. There were sunken-in little red holes. Most unsettling of all, it was just staring at me. After a few seconds of being completely paralyzed in fear, I pulled the covers back up over my head. What else could I do? I stayed there for the rest of the night until I fell asleep. I know this thing wasn't human. I told my parents the next day. They said I was dreaming. I made up a lot of stories back then. I remember a lot of them vividly, and the rest of my childhood is really, really hazy. But seeing that thing in my room is one of those childhood memories that just stuck with me the most. I have no idea what it was, and despite my fascination with horror stories, I don't think I want to know.
Jesse.
When I was a kid, I had an imaginary friend named Jesse. I don't really remember much about him, but I remember my parents asking about him quite a lot and seeming quite concerned. A couple of years ago, while visiting relatives in Ireland, we were all exchanging ghost stories. When my mom brought up Jesse, I was quite confused because I thought he was just an imaginary friend. My mom started off by saying how she didn't understand why I called him Jesse, as I never heard the name before. And she didn't know anyone who was called that. I didn't think that was too weird, it's just a name, right? Then she said that one time when my dad was on his way to work, I asked him to bring back some coal for Jesse's gran. My dad was an electrician in the mine at the time. I was about 2 or 3 at the time, and wouldn't have understood what a mine was, even if I knew he worked in one. The end of her story was when we were on a day trip to a place we visited a lot when I was really young. I suddenly just ran off. They followed me into a graveyard. I ran straight to a small grave and stopped and just stared at it. It was Jesse's grave. I felt quite creeped out that I spent a lot of time as a child playing with a ghost.
Something bad at Devil's Den.
Terry Loveless, ex-assistant attorney general for the state of Vermont until his retirement, was keen to tell his story. Yet he had never disclosed this information for fear of losing his job and standing in the legal community. It concerns an incident near Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri. Here's his story, how he used to tell it. 1977. Toby and I were both city kids. Neither one of us had ever been camping in our lives. There are plenty of National Forest campgrounds all around us, but Toby convinced me the long drive to Devil's Den was worth it because it offered 1. A high plateau where you could stargaze without light pollution, 2. I could photograph wildlife and scenery. He was against staying at the park's campground, comparing it to camping in a parking lot in the woods. So, we trespassed deep into the nature preserve that was off limits and set up our camp on the edge of the plateau, abutting a tree line. When we were 4 hours into our drive south toward the Arkansas border, I realized I left my damn camera on my kitchen counter. It was a big disappointment, but I was determined to make the best of it. We did bring our small tent, insect repellent and sunscreen, and enough food and water for 2 overnights. On our first night, we were exhausted from the long drive, setting up a campsite, and the hike we took when we first arrived. About 9 p.m., Toby noticed 3 stars on the horizon. They made a perfect triangle. They were small at first and moved in perfect unison. It became obvious that this was one solid object and not 3 independent lights orchestrated to move in perfect formation. We watched it ascend and grow closer and much larger until it was directly over the top of our campsite. We noticed that as it passed through a star field, it blotted them out until it moved past. Then they would blink back on. So it was one solid object. It was odd that at first this thing in the sky made us anxious, but that soon dissipated. We noticed the whole forest was now dead silent. An hour earlier, it had been alive with crickets and tree frogs. While this thing was over our heads, we became abruptly disinterested. We were also suddenly drowsy. Not tired, but almost sedated. At midnight, we just decided to get in the tent and go to sleep. The apathy puzzles me to this day. I woke up at 3 a.m. to brilliant multicolored lights. White, yellow, and orange illuminated the inside of our tent. Through a small net window, I saw the forest behind us was lit up like a night game at a ballpark. I noticed my clothing and boots were all askew. I pushed Toby aside so we could both look outside toward the meadow. There was an enormous UFO as large as a 5-story office building. It was a triangle with each leg being about a city block in length. It was 50 feet tall and sat stationary, 30 feet over the meadow floor. There was a noise too. It was a low bass hum or drone. Not so much loud as it was powerful. It was like standing next to a running diesel train engine or a large industrial machine. We saw what I first took to be children walking around the meadow underneath the triangle. There was a column of white light, about 30 feet in diameter, shining down from the center of the triangle. We watched as these little people walked into the light and just dissolved, one by one until they were gone. The hum stopped, and the corner lights all returned to brilliant white. The white cylinder from the middle stopped, and the thing rose about like a hot air balloon. It made a 1/3 clockwise rotation and continued its ascent, picking up speed until it was high in the sky and then gone. While we were apathetic earlier, now we were scared out of our wits. We abandoned our campsite and ran to the car and drove back to base. Toby left his backpack with his name and base address written inside. This is how they were able to find us so quickly. Both of us suffered severe sunburn all over our bodies. Even the soles of my feet were burned. We were terribly dehydrated. We spent a couple of days in the hospital, the same hospital where we worked. While hospitalized, we were interrogated separately by 2 men in business suits. They identified themselves as special agents from the OSI. The OSI is the Office of Special Investigations. It's the investigative arm of the USAF Security Police. I recall the older man was a major and the younger a captain. Intermittently over the next 10 years, I was plagued with dreadful nightmares about that night. At my wife's suggestion, I began to keep a journal of my nightmares. I kept a pen and paper by my bedside and did my best to document each nightmare before it evaporated. I think that helped me. Ever since 1977, I am uncomfortable being outside in open spaces, especially after dark. I sleep with a light or the television on. I keep a loaded 380 by my bedside table and a high-intensity flashlight. I feel anxious at the mall when we walk past a window display with naked mannequins in the window. I became a non-competitive runner in 1980, and I ran until I had a heart problem in 2005. When I ran, there was a spot on my right leg the size of a $0.50 that went completely numb every time I passed the 2-mile mark. Every time. It would remain numb for 30 minutes or so. In 2012, I had an x-ray of my leg following an incident. If you look at the x-ray to the very top and far right, you'll see a metal object the size of a postage stamp. It is directly over what I call my numb spot. There's no scar to indicate the site where this thing entered my body. According to a radiologist, absent a scar, I would have to be born with this thing in my leg. The x-ray brought with it intrusive thoughts and terrible images from 1977. After a 40-year hiatus, nightmares about 1977 have returned and still disturb my sleep. Something bad happened to us at Devil's Den.
Woman with red hair.
When I was a little kid, I had an imaginary friend, a woman with red hair. My parents were sick and tired of me always talking to myself and considered taking me to a psychologist. Those plans were dashed one night when my dad came into my room after hearing me talk to myself. He told me we were leaving for the grocery store and I asked if I could bring my friend along. My dad wanted to prove to me I was just seeing things and told me he had to meet my friend before they could come with us. I looked confused and didn't know what to tell him when suddenly I screamed of joy. She's standing right behind you. My parents screamed as our old neighbor, who had recently been evicted, was found hiding in our closet.
Pumi and Punky.
When I was 3 or 4, my family lived in a 1950s ranch house that my parents bought at a sheriff's sale. It's kind of run down, but it was a bargain. It was only a few blocks from my grandmother's home, on the same block as my sister's school. My dad could be at work in 5 minutes. It had a carport. In there was a utility closet. The closet housed the hot water heater, a furnace, and a trap door down into the crawl space below the house. The utility closet was in a short L-shaped hallway between the kitchen and the den, which we used as a family room. I remember the crawl space always had a dirty water smell to it. The floor of the crawl space wasn't poured concrete, but was composed of loose gravel. So our routine was pretty regular. My dad would go to work. My sister was in kindergarten, so all day it was just my mom and I until it was time to walk to the school to get her. My mom had a side job decorating cakes. While she was in the kitchen, I would play alone in the den. My mom would hear me carrying on long conversations with my toys. One of my favorite things was to make a cave by lifting the leg rest of the recliner and playing with my toys underneath it. It used to annoy my mother because I never put it back down. One day she asked me why I always did that. I told her, because the light from the big window hurts their eyes. She asked, "The light hurts your toys' eyes?" "No, the two little black boys who come out to play with me." That freaked her out. She talked to my dad about it, and they asked me more about it. I told them I had two friends named Pumi and Punky. They were two little black boys that lived under the heater in the utility closet. Pumi always wanted to play, but he had to drag Punky along with him. Punky never wanted to come, but they weren't allowed to ever be apart. They were both terrified of my dad. They would disappear back in the closet when they would hear him coming. At night, since my dad was home, they were too afraid to come out. They would fall down into the crawl space and crawl until they were under my bedroom. Sometimes they would whisper jokes to me through the floorboards, but mostly I would just hear them moving around in the gravel. It ended when my mom found me sitting in the utility closet with the door shut. I told her that Pumi and Punky had to leave because a raggedy man who walked along the train tracks at night almost found them. They saw him in our backyard trying to peek through the screen door. How did they leave? They crawled into the furnace, turned into cinders, and flew out through the chimney. Then I just grew up and that was that.
Oh, that John.
In 2007, I went on a date with a guy from Craigslist. I was 17 years old at the time. I put an ad looking to meet someone. I don't remember the details. A guy responded who lived close to me, so I emailed him back and gave him my number. He's actually one of the only ones who responded without a creepy message. He said his name was John. He was 26 years old. This guy John and I spoke for 2 days before meeting, and we met on a Friday night. We texted back and forth. He asked if I was single. I said yes. He asked what kind of food I like to eat because he wanted to take me to a restaurant. I asked him a few questions about himself. He told me that he still lived with his mother but had the top floor to himself, and that he was a part-time model that made good money. Judging by his picture, him being a model was fairly believable. On Friday night, John comes to pick me up. He drove a silver two-door car. I want to say Ford. He popped me a message to say that he was waiting outside, and after checking my hair and makeup one last time, I said goodbye to my parents, telling them I was heading out with friends, and left. I got into John's car, and the first thing I noticed was that he looked exactly like his photo, the tall, dark, and handsome type. He had pale skin with dark hair and dark eyes. He looked a little older in person, but he made up for it with a snappy fashion sense. He looked cool and cute. He was incredibly kind. His body language and smile totally put me at ease. Yes, it's really stupid to go on a date from Craigslist, but surprisingly, this guy was normal. We chatted for a while as he started driving away from my hometown towards the highway. He wanted to drive us into the city to go to dinner, which wasn't too far, around a 25-minute journey. John started to reveal more details about himself to me on this journey. He told me he was embarrassed to tell me he lived with his mother and that I might think bad of him for not having his own place at his age. John got closer and closer to the highway. And I can't tell you what it was. I won't make it up because I don't remember. But it wasn't anything remotely creepy. I just felt put off by him. You know, when you're on a date with someone and you're not sure and then they tell you something that's your biggest turnoff? It was that kind of situation. Again, he didn't say anything too creepy, just off-putting. As we're getting closer and closer to the turnoff, I tell this perfectly nice guy, "I'm really sorry, I don't feel like going to dinner anymore, I'm not feeling well." John's initial reaction was sympathy. "What's wrong? Are you okay? Is it my driving?" I told him I just didn't feel well. John then kept asking me, "What did I say? What did I do?" I told him, "It's not him, it's me, I wanted to go home because I felt ill." Then he said, "Okay. Let me just drive around for a little bit before I take you back. I don't want to end the evening like this." I knew that without him driving me home, I'd have to walk over an hour, maybe more, so I told him that driving for a bit sounded like a fine idea. But instead of him turning around and going back towards my house, he veered off and started heading to the town I knew he lived in. I should mention it was pitch black out. The town where John lived was surrounded by dense wood. This isn't even worth mentioning if you take the highway and proper turnoffs to get there, but he decided he wanted to go via the back roads because it's more scenic, despite the fact that I couldn't see anything. John had gone from being incredibly talkative to almost completely silent. He kept driving further into the wooded area. A few times I'd ask him questions about himself to break the awkward silence. At one point, I put my hand on his knee, affectionately, trying to regain the friendly, flirty banter we had earlier. He blanked me for the most part, occasionally answering in soft grunts or nods. It was like he was having a tantrum. John pulled into the parking lot for the forest. It was around 9 p.m., so naturally it was totally empty. He slowly kept driving, looking around for other cars, and then parked himself up right at the end, close to the woods. There's nobody else in the parking lot, and I even seen us pass other cars to get there. For 10 minutes, he just sat there, staring into the darkness ahead, which was disturbing. I think I managed to make small talk for maybe 5 minutes, which is a long time when someone isn't talking back. Then I joined him in the silence. I was afraid of appearing fake. I didn't want him to think I was scared. So sometime a silence goes past and abruptly, John gets out of the car, closes the door and locks the car. I was stuck inside. His lights were on so I could sort of see ahead. In front of the car was a field that maybe went on for about 20 feet, so really just a patch of grass. And then beyond that were trees and dense forest. To the left was the rest of the car park, an exit at the far end. To the immediate right was more forest with a small path. John disappeared into the forest ahead. I tried the handle on the door, wouldn't open. I began to rationalize this, maybe he accidentally locked the door. I was telling myself if he really wanted to do something, he'd have stayed in the car. With no sight of John, I decided I needed to call someone. I looked around for my phone, couldn't find it. This was an old, silvery, pay-as-you-go flip phone. I was confused that I couldn't find it because I had put it right next to me in the cup holder. After looking for it for a good few minutes, I became sure he had taken it. Mind you, I didn't want to start rooting around his car knowing he might be watching me. I didn't want him to catch on that I was freaking out. At that point, I started looking for my phone with only my eyes instead of making it obvious. I was petrified this guy was watching me panic in the darkness. My eyes were darting all around the floor. Nothing. I looked up and squinted into the field and forest ahead. I saw him. John was standing about 10 feet from the car on that small field. He was standing and smiling. It wasn't a friendly smile. He looked freaky. This is not the same guy I got in the car with. I looked ahead and smiled back. I was still trying to act like his behavior was normal, like nothing he was doing was scary. still smiling. His tongue began to protrude from his mouth. He stuck it out all the way. He began wagging his tongue up and down while maintaining eye contact with me. I felt myself trembling. I was trying to compose myself. Not taking his eyes off of me, and with his tongue still out, he started unzipping his pants. He took out his penis and proceeded to urinate in front of me while I was staring the whole time. This is the point I found it difficult to act like I was in on his behavior. I looked down at the floor, not wanting to watch what was in front of me. He didn't creep or slink back into the car. Instead, I hear his thundering steps and then a slam against the window. I guess at this point I was the luckiest person alive because another car pulled into the parking lot. I didn't know what this did to John, but immediately he got back into the car and laughed at me, that normal laugh, and said, "So, what music do you like? I'll put it on while I drive you home." And he did. He drove me all the way home. When we pulled up to my house, I went for the door, but it was still locked. "I want you to promise me something." I asked him what that was. "If you see me, if you ever see me after this, turn the other way. Act like you don't know me. If you see me with my family, don't you dare say a word. I don't expect to bump into you, but don't say anything." I agreed. Then I asked him, have you seen my phone?" He told me no. I guess my phone was a small sacrifice for surprisingly making it home okay. When I got in, I said goodnight to my parents and went upstairs in my room and turned on my computer. I wanted to gather as much information about the guy as I could. Back then, I used MSN Messenger. It's like AIM. It logged in automatically whenever I started up my PC. Now, before I get to the final part of the story, it's important you know this. One day before, I had been at my best friend's house. We had the kind of friendship where it was like, who could pick on the other the most? It was all good fun and we mostly just ripped the hell out of each other and had a laugh. The day before, she had changed two contacts on my phone, an old prank, replaced the contact mom with a guy I had been sending sexual texts back and forth with. I immediately knew she had done this because I saw the previous messages come up, but I didn't change the numbers back at the time, thinking I'd do it later. So when I logged on to MSN, I had a ton of messages from this guy and a few from my best friend. When John had locked me in the car, he had taken my phone and texted mom, telling her, "I'm sorry, but I decided to move out. I met someone. Please don't look for me. I am happy being left alone." Another thing about the message was that it was all written in text speak. Swap please for PLZ, for example. And this guy knew I never texted like that. Aside from the message itself, this was a big red flag. He had texted me back, showed me on the cam, a question mark, before texting again saying, "I don't think this is you. I know where you went and I'm calling the police." This was incredibly quick thinking as he had absolutely no idea where I was. I think that text saved my life that night and explains John's sudden change of behavior. If it wasn't the random car, it was the text. Afterwards, we tried to find this guy online by name and by email. Couldn't find anything. It seemed everything on him was fake. My best friend pressed me to call the police, but I never did because I feared the retribution I'd get from my parents for going on a date with a guy I didn't know. My friend ended up betraying my trust. I know, she's the smart one. Telling my mom anyway, who still didn't call the police but instead did what I expected and banned me from my PC and going out while also calling me an idiot. There's something else. Turns out this guy's first name was John, and he did in fact live in the town he said he lived in. Around 3 years later, I started going out with a guy from that very town. His name was Chris. We're talking about exes one day and I told him about my creepy encounter. I didn't even get halfway through the story before he stopped and started asking questions about what John looked like, how old he looked, how old he said he was, etc. Turns out, Chris knew John. This guy was now in prison for attacking and raping a 14-year-old girl and beating her bloody in a nearby park. She survived without long-term injury. That was just what he was in prison for, though. My friend told me he was well known for being a creep way before that, and his friends even called him Creepy John. He would go around the nearby parks where he knew the younger girls hung out, and he would ask them to get in his car or take their photo. He'd always tell them he was a model too. My boyfriend at the time first met him when he was 12 because John decided to take up skateboarding and try to make friends with lots of the young boys in the skate park. Chris couldn't believe I'd actually gotten into the car with John. Anyway, that's my story about possibly, maybe, nearly being murdered. I hope you'd enjoyed. If anyone's wondering, yes, the guy is still in prison today.
Johnny's Corner.
Hard to say what qualifies as creepy. The story could be seen as heartwarming. My mother swears this is a true story. Frankly, I don't see why she would lie about it. My mom had three kids. There's me, the youngest, and my older brother. But before either of us were born, there was Jonathan. He was a sweet little blonde boy, big blue eyes, known for accidentally repeating dad's swears in church. Wholesome kid, great in school, active outside. When he was almost six, he was riding his bike and fell. He hit his head on a rock. He got up and said he felt fine. My mom found him the next morning in his bed. When she tried to wake him up for school, one pupil was dilated and the other not. She got him airlifted to the nearest hospital. During this time, Jonathan's best friend Nick was sitting at the breakfast table eating cereal. Nick suddenly gets up from the table and goes to the door. When his mom asks him what's up, Nick says that Johnny was calling for him. Nick and Johnny lived on separate blocks. They weren't allowed to cross the street without a parent yet because they were still fairly young. But they lived close enough to call to one another to come out and talk at their respective street corners. Nick goes out to the street corner while his mother receives a call from mine. Johnny was just declared dead in the hospital. Idle brain aneurysm that was triggered by the fall. Nick's mom can hardly handle the news and is now wondering where her son went. Nick comes back a few minutes later and says that he heard Johnny calling to him, but Johnny wasn't at the street corner when he looked. Then Nick sits down to continue eating his cereal. When his mom asked Nick what Johnny was saying, Nick says he had come to say goodbye. My mom told me this story when I was young, but it stuck with me. I wish I could have met him. My parents said if they had known that what happened was possible, they would have stopped Johnny from doing all the fun things he ended up doing, playing baseball, climbing trees, and just being a kid, and that would have been like having no life at all. Plus, it was the 80s, and there was no reason to suspect such a thing would be an issue for such a bright, energetic boy. But truthfully, I wouldn't be here if he hadn't died. My mother only wanted two kids. I'm thankful for the chance I was given to live and feel like he died for me sometimes. I'm not religious, but I do feel spiritual when I think of Johnny. It's scary to think of a little trigger in your brain just waiting to be set off to kill you.
Family hauntings.
I grew up in the same house for years. I was 4 when we first moved in and 21 when we left. So this is a few stories from my family that happened in that home. At first, I would share a small bedroom with my mom. My dad would sleep in the living room. My aunt and uncle shared the master bedroom. My brothers both shared a room. My whole family would talk about odd things happening. I think it started with my mom hearing footsteps in the living room. Our house was old. It was built in 1924. It would easily shake when someone would walk. My mom would hear these steps in the middle of the night. She originally thought it was my dad, as these steps sounded heavy. Every time she checked, however, he would be sound asleep on his bed. She would also tell my dad how she would feel someone pulling her hair and feet at night. Although she was scared, she would not scream because she did not want to scare me. Another night, she was in the living room with my dad watching TV when she heard what sounded like porcelain hitting the back of the cabinet a few times, as if it were falling and finally hitting the carpet. She thought maybe it was one of the little porcelain dolls she had placed on top of it and decided to check in the morning. When she checked the next morning, nothing was there. One day, one of my aunts came to visit the aunt who lived in our home. They were sitting in the living room when they heard someone with heavy footsteps walk up to the front door. They also thought it was my dad and expected him to come walking in any minute, but no one did. They went out to check, but no one was at the door. They didn't hear anyone walk away either. They brushed it off. Another time, my aunt was home alone cooking in the kitchen when she saw a bright, almost shining, gangster-looking person walk from the living room into mine and my mom's bedroom. She chased him, screaming, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" To her surprise, when she went into the bedroom, no one was there. At some point, my dad got my brothers and I a basketball to play with. The first day we had it, we put it outside my bedroom window. Late at night, my mom heard it bounce. Bounce, 1, 2, 3, bounce. 1, 2, 3. It was in rhythm. She thought it was us kids playing and was ready to yell at us. But when she looked out the window, no one was there. This happened 3 more times. My mom eventually got sick of it, thinking it was all in her head, moved the ball to the opposite side of the house next to my aunt's window. The next day, my aunt came to my mom and asked her if we were playing outside her window last night. My mom told her no, and asked her why she was asking. Well, my aunt had heard the ball bouncing. My mom asked if it was in rhythm. My aunt said yes. My mom popped the ball with a knife and threw it in the trash after that. Now for my brother's stories. One day, they were both sitting in their beds watching TV when my mom and I came to their room to bring them food. I don't remember this at all, but my mom said their bedroom doorknob had twisted and their door had opened by itself. My brothers thought she was the one who opened it, and she thought they were the ones who did it. They all agreed to disagree, denying what they saw. Late one night, my brothers had left their bedroom door open, so they had a full view of the bathroom and hallway. One of them woke up for some reason. He looked at the hallway. That's when he saw a black figure crouched on the floor next to the restroom door. He woke up my other brother, and they both stared at the figure for about a minute or so. The figure stood up and disappeared before their eyes. On another night, they were hanging out with their friends outside. I was with them, and I recall this all happening. They kept pointing at a figure in the backyard. My brother ran in the house, brought out a flashlight, but when he tried to shine it, it would not work. I recall all of us debating on whether or not to go back there and see what it was, but we're all too scared. We called it a night and came inside. Out of curiosity, my brother turned the flashlight on. It was working perfectly fine. We were shocked. I recall we took a trip out to Mexico. We stayed in my grandma's, on the mom's side, house. I was about 8 years old, and I really wanted to see my grandma, my dad's mom, so I stayed up. For context, we all slept in the living room of the house. There were a few beds, so my family of five just slept there. The beds were pushed right up against the wall. You wouldn't be able to stick your hand in there. That's how tight against the wall they were. I kept looking at the clock, waiting for daylight so we could walk to Grandma's house. It's about 5 a.m. I looked at my mom's head, and I saw a hand come out of where the bed and wall met. A pitch black hand at her head, as if it were aiming to grab her hair. I vividly remember thinking how weird it was to see how black this hand was. You know when your eyes are adjusted to the night and everything is somewhat a dark blue color? This hand was solid black compared to the rest of the blue-hued room. The strangest part was it turned to me, the palm facing me as if it saw me, and it quickly lowered behind the bed and the wall. I didn't feel any sort of fear, just full-on confusion. How did it fit there? Why was it so dark? Eventually, my dad woke up and we left to Grandma's. I didn't tell anyone. Now, for the finale. We came back from our vacation. All the stories of our home were building up and everyone was telling my dad what was going on. He denied it for a while, claiming nothing had ever happened to him, so it's not true. Then it happened. My dad woke up to the heavy footsteps in the hallway, right next to where he slept. Next morning, he told my mom and agreed this was something paranormal. They went to church down the street and asked the priest to bless our home. The priest came by that same night, blessed the home with no issue. And that was it. Just like that, everything was over. At some point, I told my mom about the hand in Mexico, and boy, was she shocked. It's as if I confirmed it to her. To this day, she fears the spirit may still be following her around. She freaks out at any mention of a black figure. As for my old home, I later found out an old woman had fallen in the restroom and died, and a gang member was shot and killed in the house. Those were probably the spirits my aunt and brother saw. I just hope they both found peace.
I'm leaving now.
Some stories I've told before, others I haven't. Some I managed to forget until something awakens it, like a beast on the dark. Here's my unexplained stories. While in college, I worked for a campus police department. I used to hang around the office between classes because why not? One day the chief comes in and asks if he can get a plainclothes search party for this kid that hadn't been seen in 2 days. Sure, I says. All 30 of us spread out in pairs to search. While near the south corner of the campus, we're looking in bushes, near buildings, and in some access paths, normal passed out drunk locations. I see this guy staring at me while standing on a landscaping wall. Weird. I mention it to my partner. He's all, think about it later, we gotta search. Eventually we come to the other side of that wall. The chief comes over the radio calling off the search. After so many hours, we're giving up. My actual shift started a number of hours later and I'm immediately pulled aside for a security shift. It's at the exact place where I was when the search was canceled. I arrived in time to see the man from the wall being carted into an ambulance. He had fallen off the wall after drunkenly climbing it 2 days before. My partner and I swore we wouldn't say anything about what we'd seen. Next story. Another time, same job. This university has a nuclear reactor used for research. Since its output is supposedly weapons-grade material, it has pretty tight security hooked up to the system at the dispatch desk, including audio-visual surveillance and motion and vibration sensors. One day, I'm chilling with the dispatcher on a night shift because I've got a spare hour. A motion sensor goes off in the control room. Nothing appears on the video. Dispatcher grumbles at that damn cat. Sure enough, in the break room next to a control, a cat walks out of the wall, sits on the table for a second, then vanishes. Over the course of the next 10 minutes, we watch as alarm after alarm activates, including one labeled reactor pool, usually accompanied by video of a cat. I watched amazed as the dispatcher calls the unit sitting outside the reactor and reports that Schrödinger is at it again. A grumpy full-time cop walks through the building, clearing room after room, including a few with a cat watching. He reports all clear. No cats. Last story. I moved into a new house over the winter. My first actual house I've owned on my own, so I was pretty stoked. My wife and I just had our second kid just a week before signing, so we're excited to get her room remodeled for her. Walls painted, floors redone, making this house ours. The first thing we set up is a baby monitor, as the children's rooms are on the opposite side of the house. At first, there were no issues. Baby didn't enjoy the room during the day. She'd stare at the walls as if she didn't like the pale purple paint. We painted them a nice orange that weekend. We also got a cat. That's when things started getting weird. The cat and the baby now had no problem with the room in the day. Our daughter was too young to do much other than be calm or fuss, but the cat was old enough to be a bit more expressive. All day she'd stare at the southeast corner of the room. At night she'd arch her back and hiss as if threatened. We'd start hearing faint noises like talking over the monitor at night, but never loud or clear enough to make out. I'm nothing if not a logical man. That corner had an old dresser that was rescued from an old army hotel when it closed. Perhaps the cat could sense old smells it didn't like. There was also the entrance to the crawl space under that corner on the outside, so a lot of wires entered through there. Both children and small animals are sensitive to electromagnetic radiation. I went under the house and removed about 100 feet of extraneous wiring from the previous owner's satellite TV. I rewired the section of the house to eliminate possible interference and replace old wires with shielded cable. We also moved the dresser, just in case. But the noises didn't stop. They grew more frequent. The cat refused to go in the room during the day. The cat would sit awake in the crib all night, body between the baby and the rest of the room, eyes locked to that corner, occasionally growling or hissing. We stopped letting our son have his radio on at night in case we were hearing that. As we met our neighbors, we would ask if they had any small children, but none had baby monitors of their own. We installed an alarm system. I took to keeping my favorite rifle loaded by the bed. Occasionally, the alarm would claim our daughter's window would open, but no alarm would sound, and we'd find it secure when checked. We ran out of explanations. We began letting our daughter sleep with us so she could get better rest. For lack of a better option, I continued renovation. We finished the bathroom, started on the other rooms, but didn't do any more in the nursery. Out of morbid curiosity, we left the baby monitor on at night. The noises still happened, but with that room being unused, they sounded almost sad. After a week or so without any use of that room whatsoever, I was lying awake after a long day at work watching an episode of Bones. Out of nowhere, clear as day, a woman's voice comes across over the monitor and calmly says, "It's okay, I'm leaving now." The monitor clicked off. We've had no problems since. I talked to my wife about it, and we recalled one phrase the old owners said during the closing. They had their third kid and the house wasn't big enough anymore. We had noticed a fair amount of construction material they left behind. The wife of the old couple said, looking at her husband, "Well, we had thought of an addition, but then there was that thing." They didn't make much eye contact after that, and that's about as far as an answer we got about what happened.
River Bottoms.
I grew up in a small mountain town in Utah, away from civilization, up on a canyon. If you walk out my back door and through a 200-yard field, you will come upon a river and small wooded area. We always called these the river bottoms, for obvious reasons. Summer of 2004, just before I turned 16, our house was the go-to party location. Always clean parties. Lots of people would show up, and most nights we would end up having a bonfire in the backyard with guitars and just chill and watch the fire and the stars. One night, we decided to start telling ghost stories. One of my close friends lived a mile down the road, with his house the same distance away from the same river bottoms. Discussion turns from the fake ghost stories to real talk about weird things that have happened to us, and my friend quickly takes the attention. He tells two stories. The first was when he was younger, 10 or 11, he says. He wakes up in the middle of the night in the dead of winter and decided to go downstairs for a glass of water. His kitchen sink faces the river bottoms. While drinking, he looks up at the window and sees a man's face looking at him from outside. He drops the glass, it shatters on the floor, and his mom comes in to see what happened. They turn on the porch light and look outside, where there had been fresh snow, and there was no man or any footprints. Okay, must have been a reflection, sure. A couple of weeks later, he is outside playing in the snow, just after dark, and his dog starts barking and growling towards the river bottoms. He looks out, can't see anything, but gets a weird feeling in his stomach and starts to go inside. He's about to get to the back door when he hears his dog behind him yelp. Then he comes running towards him, again turns around and can't see anything, and it runs inside. He finished the story saying that he always had this fear of the river bottoms and doesn't like going out there. Naturally, as a bunch of young men with something to prove, a few of my friends decided they are going to go out there and explore. It is nearly a full moon and a clear night, so visibility is pretty good. I think 5 made the first trip. They leave about 15 or so of us just chilling around the fire for about 10 minutes, definitely not long enough to really get to the bottoms and explore anything, and they come running back to the fire. A few of them say they saw something out there which isn't too out of the ordinary. The field between my backyard and the bottoms frequently has cows, and it is really common to see deer, coyotes, and other wildlife in the area. We talk them down and resume the guitars. One of my older brother's friends is sitting with his back facing the bottoms, has been unusually quiet since he got back, and keeps turning his head and looking behind him. At 6'5 and 240 plus, it was very out of character. Eventually, a second group decides to go out. This time we go inside and gather up flashlights, hockey sticks, baseball bats, whatever we can find, just in case. This time we have a group of about 10, which includes myself. We get about halfway to the river bottoms when I start to get a really dark feeling. I relate it to fear, but it was so much more, just like something was not right. The only time I had felt fear like this was when I had a gun pointed at me a couple of years ago and had a genuine fear for my life. Then we start to hear this faint whistle, almost like you would hear with the wind in a wooded area, but we weren't in the trees yet. Then we heard it again in a different direction. Then, directly behind us, much faster than a person could have moved without being heard or seen. We get freaked out and clump together. We hear the whistle again, and the two with the flashlights both zero in on the spot to our left, and what we see for just a fraction of a second is a dark silhouette, maybe 3 to 4 feet high, and red reflection in the eyes. Then it darts away at insane speed, and we lose it. Knowing that everyone saw this thing, we all make a mad dash for the house. Getting back to the fire, we decide we didn't want to stay there any longer. We put out the fire. In typical youth fashion, all the boys stood in a circle and peed on it until the coals were gone, and climbed in the cars and left. About an hour or so later, my brother and I get home. As we're pulling into the driveway, we see the fire in a blaze again. Still feeling creeped out, we go to put it out with the hose, and all the wood that we had in stack and a few feet away had been thrown into the pit. Mega weird. Here's where the story really gets interesting. The next day, we're having Sunday dinner with my parents. My dad grew up in the 50s in the neighboring house to where we currently live. They asked if we had fun last night, and my brother said, yeah, but I don't know if anyone will be coming back anymore. My dad was like, why's that? Did you guys see the boogeyman? Yeah, Dad, we saw the boogeyman, chuckled my brother sarcastically. My dad was like, really? I saw the boogeyman once. I was really little, probably 8 or 9. I remember I was really sick and had a fever, but I remember looking out my front door one night about dusk and seeing this dark shape next to our mailbox. Its head was just below the mailbox and was looking at me with glowing red eyes. My brother and I both look at each other like, did you tell him what happened? We both knew that he had to have been telling the truth. A few weeks later, we are again having a bonfire at the house when we notice that the river bottom seems to be glowing a little ways away. We hop in the car and get almost to my friend's house when we see that the bottoms are on fire. We call 911 to report it. It is government land, and decide to go out and see it for ourselves while waiting for the FD to get there. It wasn't super out of control, and as we got close, we see that it is just the grass burning in a small clearing. We decide that we probably could even stamp it out. It just looks like a few lines burning in about a 10-foot radius. We get it out, and one of my friends starts walking in a circle following the burned ash and looking towards the middle. Then he starts to climb a tree, and as he gets a few feet up, he says, "Guys, this is a pentagram." The super weird thing is that it had been burning for at least 20 to 30 minutes before we got out there, but the grass was still burned in a perfect pentagram, no spreading at all. Super weird. A few days later, we hear about how there were people arrested a couple of years ago for performing devil worship in the river bottoms. They would regularly burn pentagrams into the ground and slaughter animals in the center. So over the next year, the story spreads through the town and it becomes this sort of legend. My brother has this mythology class in the spring, and the final project is to create a myth. The teacher, knowing this story, suggests to my brother that he uses this as his story and give it some depth. Greek mythology integrated with real life, my brother gives life to the name of Nephus Gaufen, or Gau for short, about a mortal cursed by Zeus for having an affair with Hera, doomed to be a river demon for the rest of his life. But the background story is not enough. He decides that he needs evidence. We decide to start the night off the same way we did the first night. Bonfire with about 15 to 20 people, guitars, ghost stories, then Gao stories. We called this the ritual, and it seemed to invite whatever it was. After a couple hours, we decide it is time. We head towards the bottoms of the video camera, in night mode. A spotlight, everyone has their own flashlight, BB guns, you name it. We get about halfway out, and the dark feeling comes back. Again, I really have to stop and stress this feeling. Fear, like you know something wants you dead. This time we don't hear the whistling, but we do hear a rush of something moving quickly and very close. We can't imagine to get it in the light or on camera, so we decide that we have to keep going. We're about 20 yards from the bottoms, and there's a small hill ridge that separates the field from the river. The front person stops moving and asks for a spotlight. He shines it up on this ridge, and standing next to a tree is the black shape. Glowing red eyes, probably 4 feet tall, looks just like a child wearing a hooded trench coat, but so black that it seems to be made of a black hole. It stays there and stares right back at us. It felt like forever it was there, all of us looking at it. Does everyone see that? With our cameraman just saying, "Focus, focus." Then it slowly takes 2 steps towards the tree, disappears behind it, and doesn't come out the other side. Screw the project, screw everyone else, panic sets in, and everyone starts running towards the house. We get to the backyard, where we have to cross a barbed wire fence. Our house does have a lot of outdoor lighting, so we figure once we cross the fence we'll be safe. The cameraman is on the field side, still pointed towards the bottoms, when he realizes he is the last one on that side of the fence. Quick panic, and he turns to hop over. We all get inside, and after trying to calm down, we decide to take a look at the footage. We watch everything, trying to see if we caught anything weird on the early part. Nothing. We get to the ridge, and the camera just did not want to focus. It faces the ridge, super blurry. He pulls it down, looks at feet. It would focus, back up again, and again blurry. You could hear, "It's going behind the tree," and then bam, focus as clear as day. Obviously disappointed, everyone starts up their own conversations. My brother starts the tape over again from the beginning and sits right below the TV just staring at it, no talking. He is pausing, rewinding, frame by frame, at the blurry part, trying to find something, but none of the footage seems usable. He gets to the part where we're almost back to the house, and my friend, the one from the beginning of the story, just happened to be watching, and at the end says, "Hold on, go back." They go really slow, frame by frame again, as the cameraman hops the fence. As he hops, the camera faces slightly into the yard to his left, and standing next to a tree not 5 feet away, is a small black figure with red glowing eyes. In the yard, 5 feet away from him, less than 10 away from most of the rest of us. None of us saw it or knew it was there, but we had it on camera. So back in those days, we had these things called VHS tapes. You put movies on them. My brother and his friend edited the movie and made 2 copies, one for us, one to turn into his teacher for the project. These tapes both included the footage we shot that night, as well as most of the story I've told here. A couple of years later, my brother and I decided we wanted to watch it, and we cannot find the tape anywhere. We searched the whole house, nothing. We did not want to fail, so we called up his mythology teacher, who we know had the tape and had even shown it to his classes, and asked if we could borrow it to copy it. And of course, he almost seems to have misplaced his copy. To this day, I still don't go into the river bottoms. I don't like to bring up the story when people or family members ask me to tell it, because I know they all think I'm either lying or that it was just youthful fear playing tricks on my mind. I know what I saw, and I know what I felt. It was real. Though I don't know what it was, something decided to come and torment me and my friends in our teenage years, and I am 100% confident in saying that it wanted to see all of us dead. Thank you for listening to Just the Terror with Nick Guerra. Make sure to check out True Scary Stories with Edie on Tuesdays. Give it 5 stars. And stay scared, uglies.